As we get closer to our own present experience, there's a certain hesitancy that comes into my mind, thinking about issues of theological liberalism and conservatism and the ecumenical movement and all these things that, people in the audience and the class probably have very valid opinions of their own on. So, if I perchance tread on anyone's toes or tip over your sacred cows with anything that I'm saying here tonight, please don't hesitate to reach out and talk about it because, most of these things are, I've found are worth having discussions about. And, I'm certainly not above learning something myself. So, all that to say, if there's anything that struck you as odd, or if you needed clarification, or if you just flat out disagreed with anything, I try to present these things in kind of as even-handed a way as I can, while also being honest to my own positions as sort of a historically grounded conservative Orthodox theologian. But I want to be fair to all parties, so please don't hesitate to reach out if there's anything in there that you wanted to talk to me about. Let me see here as we get going. Okay. Oh, we've got a message from Lyle. Still here. Lost my video feed. Okay. Let me, before I leave the subject of global Christianity, let me share that other little graphic that I included in your notes. This is a graphic that was designed a few years back by the Joshua Project, which is an agency that tracks statistics and demographics relating to world Christianity. And this shows what they call great progress, the diminishing task. The ratio of non-Christians and nominal Christians, which are the balls being carried there, to practicing Christians. So back in, 100 AD, they estimated that for every one Christian in the world, there were 360 non-Christians or nominal Christians. By 1000 AD, that number had been reduced to 270. So remember, when we think about Christian history and you think about, okay, 1000, 1500, this is when, European Christianity was at its height. Everyone was saying they were Christians. There are a lot of people all over the world who weren't in Europe and didn't have the gospel at that point. You have in 1500, 85 non-Christians to one Christian. By 1900, that's down to 21, so they've made great progress. But look at that. This is just from 100 to 1900. You've made that kind of progress. And then in the span of just a century, you have this continued dramatic reduction. Of by 2010, you've got a third, just a third of the number that you had in 1900. That is an enormous increase in Christians around the world. Now, it's not clear if this trend line will continue. There's some recent data that might suggest that we're in danger of possibly plateauing at that level. But just the shape of this graph gives me hope. I mean, the way that within just our own day, you've seen such dramatic change. I mean, think about it. In my lifetime and the lifetimes of many of us here, from 1970 to 2010, the number of non or nominal Christians to practicing Christians has effectively been cut in half. So when I say that this is the most astonishing story of church history in recent memory, and one that not enough people know about, I'm really being serious. It is when, if the Lord tarries and someone's writing a church history 500 years from now, this is going to be the lead story of our generation, is the explosion of the church around the world. Not necessarily in America and Europe right now, but in almost everywhere else. So, anyway. Useful thing to keep in mind when we think about our own current moment in history. But let's look not only at the global context, but at our own context. Here in the West, which is usually taken to refer to North America and Europe. Some of the traditional heartlands of Christianity, but not the only ones. As we've seen throughout this course, you know, there has always been a continual presence of Christianity in Africa, in places like Egypt and Ethiopia from the very beginning. There's always been a continuing presence of Christianity in Asia, in the Middle East, although its numbers have declined somewhat with the rise of Islam. But American Christianity traditionally have been some of those heartlands, and just within the 20th, early 21st century, we've seen some of that status diminish, right? So one of the big stories, obviously, in our corner of the world, in 20th century Christianity, is the effect of the world wars on global history. World War I, World War II. World War I did not have as much cultural impact on us in the U.S. as it did in Great Britain and France and Canada and Germany, places that were involved in the war from the very beginning, 1914. The U.S. didn't get involved until almost the end, 1917. And so the countries that were active in sending out just waves upon waves of thousands and thousands and thousands of their young men to die in truly atrocious conditions in the trenches in Europe, they really saw a massive cultural impact from this. I think I talked, back when we talked about the wars of religion, the post-Reformation wars of religion in Europe, this is my own personal opinion looking at history, but I think there really are cultural and social traumas that come from huge warfare incidents like that that can sometimes have effects on the course of the church. That's not to say that, you know, wars don't serve a purpose or that we ought not to get into them. I'm not making an argument for pacifism. What I am saying is that sometimes, historically speaking, we can trace a decline in Christianity to a certain point of cultural woundedness. And I think that's important to say because it should inform our approach as pastors and ministry leaders. If we end up dealing in a society that, say, has undergone some kind of trauma like that, and we really in the U.S. haven't had one to that scale since World War II. But just to know that it really does seem to have an impact on the way people consider their belief system and the way they consider their involvement in church, and it plays out for decades beyond that itself. So beginning with World War I, you really saw a pretty steep decline after World War I. In Christianity in Britain and Germany and France, places like that were heavily affected by that war. It wasn't across the board, it wasn't immediate, but it was a definite trend. So that by the time you hit World War II, places like Britain were already very, very secular places. You know, when C.S. Lewis, whom we'll mention in a moment, when he gives his radio talks that become the book Mere Christianity, He's giving those talks as a Christian to a society that largely has either chosen to leave Christianity or just thinks that they don't need it. So already by mid-century, Britain was at that place. The U.S., we might be getting to that place now. I mean, we had much deeper involvement in World War II, but if you think about it, kind of the peak of church participation was probably immediately after that, 1950s. That's what all the older folks in my church look back on as like the golden age when everybody in town was in Sunday school on a Sunday morning. But it's been a pretty significant and steady decline since then, right? And so our societies, Europe and America, are sometimes now being talked of as post-Christian. It's not a term I really like. That's why I put it in quotes on the notes. Partly because I don't buy it. In fact, I was reading an article recently that suggested that you know, not knowing the future, you could make an argument that Christian America right now is pre-Christian rather than post-Christian. And they made this case based on historical parallels with England in the 1700s. That we talked about this a little bit, that before the Great Awakening and the Evangelical Revival, religion in England had pretty much taken a nosedive in terms of practical, heartfelt Christianity amongst the populace. And it wasn't until John Wesley and George Whitefield and those guys and the revival that the Lord brought through their ministry that you got this resurgence of Great Britain as the center of English Christianity that we might think about when we think of the Victorian age. Anyway, the author of this article is saying, you know what, we tend to imagine it as just kind of this downward slope into atheism, but if the history of the church is any indication, you can probably make just as good a case that what we're seeing here is sort of a cyclical dip that's going to head the other way at a certain point. I don't know for sure. I'm not a future teller, but I am an optimist, and so I like that article a lot. Anyway, people call us post-Christian. As I say, I don't really like the term, but it is useful in the sense of understanding where people in our society might be coming from. Post-Christian in the sense that most people in the U.S. think they know what Christianity is all about. Either they were maybe raised in and out of the church, they have some background in it, or they've just known lots of people who call themselves Christians, and they've seen Christians depicted on TV, and so they think they know Christianity. So in that sense, we're not living in sort of a brand new mission field where the gospel can have that immediate impact of being the good news that nobody's ever heard of before, the way it was back in the apostolic period. Now we're faced with a little bit more of a challenge in our mission field because we have a mission field where a lot of people think they know what Christianity is and have decided they don't really need it. In many cases, I would argue, they really haven't had an honest interaction with Christianity, and that's where we come in. That's where our witness comes in. But it is a different mindset that we have to confront in our mission work. I have down here, before I skip over the world wars, I have down here two great figures of the faith that I wanted to highlight from the story of World War II. And some of you probably know these folks. Their stories are fairly widely known. You had this guy, Dietrich Bonhoeffer. He was a prominent German theologian in the 1930s. He had a number of books that are still spiritual classics today, especially The Cost of Discipleship. It's really worth reading. It's not necessarily an easy read, but it is an important book. It kind of pushed back against both the liberal Christianity of his day, which was trying to say that being a Christian is just about this subjective personal spiritual experience, pushing back on that, and also pushing back a little bit on the excesses of fundamentalists, who would sometimes preach sort of the Reformation doctrine of salvation by grace alone. There's nothing you can do to earn favor with God, and present the gospel as what he called cheap grace, right? That all you got to do is sign on the dotted line. God's done everything for you in sending Jesus, so just say yes to Jesus and you're in. Bonhoeffer says, well, hold on, that's cheap grace. That's not the picture the New Testament portrays. Yes, God has done everything for our salvation, but that still calls for something from us. It calls for discipleship. So anyway, a lot of good books. He was a really marvelous theologian. His book Life Together is also well worth reading. It's a set of reflections on the nature of being the church. And so he is one of the prominent theological voices in Germany during the rise of the Nazis. So throughout the 1930s, I think from 1932 onward, the Nazi Party was in power. and was consolidating its power. A lot of German Christians, unfortunately, did not really stand up for the gospel very well. They got bullied into, or, you know, led into sort of a syncretistic form of Christianity. So you have some really kind of horrifying pictures from the period here of pastors who are enthusiastically using the Heil Hitler salute. You have Christian cathedrals that are flying, the Nazi swastika. Really terrible, terrible capitulation of the gospel, of the church, which should have been standing up for the gospel, instead bending its knee to the abuses and the offenses of this dictatorial tyrant. Bonhoeffer wasn't one of those guys, though. He was one who decided to stand up for the gospel, and so he ran an underground church, really an underground church movement called the Confessing Church, for many years under Nazi domination. He didn't have to do that. In fact, he had a lot of friends here in the States. He could have easily rode out the war here in the U.S., had a great life as a scholar, an author, a theologian, but he wanted to be in this context where he was needed. And so he had a sort of a secret seminary that he ran to train pastors during during the Nazi regime in World War II. Eventually, he himself, he was a little bit of a pacifist, but he became so concerned with the way his country was going that he ended up joining a secret network, sort of an espionage network that was trying to assassinate Adolf Hitler from within. And they almost succeeded. They almost pulled it off, but they didn't. He ended up getting arrested, brought to a concentration camp, and he died in a concentration camp in 1945, just shortly before the Allied liberation. So he's remembered as both a great theologian, a courageous man, and also as a martyr for the sake of the gospel, because of the way that he met his end. So let's see here. We've got Dietrich Bonhoeffer and... hold on, I've got... I can't see all the names here because some of them are hiding behind... oh, what have I done now? Okay, hold on just a second. I'm going to stop sharing. And let me try that again. I wanted to bring up Corrie ten Boom. Here she is. She's another one whose name that might be familiar to some of you. Very famous story coming out of World War II. She's the author of a number of books, less theological than Dietrich Bonhoeffer, more kind of devotional, really easy to and accessible, very inspirational. Her most famous one is The Hiding Place, which is the memoir of her experiences during World War II. She was a Dutch Christian, and she and her family were active in hiding Jews from the Nazis. So they had a special room in their house where they would hide Jews who were in danger of being deported to concentration camps. And in the end, they did save quite a number of Jews and other refugees. But in the end, they were arrested, she and her sister and her father. Her father died shortly after that in imprisonment, and she and her sister were sent to an extermination camp in Germany. And the testimony that she tells about living as a Christian in the midst of one of these Nazi extermination camps is really just overwhelming in its poignancy, in its beauty. Definitely worth a read. So you did have a lot of really wonderful Christians, even in the midst of the pain and devastation of that war. Of course, you had, you know, Christians on serving in various aspects. Both of my grandfathers are veterans of World War II. In fact, my grandfather has his story of coming to faith in the Lord comes from World War II. He was a Navy guy, young guy, maybe 20 years old. Or maybe, no, probably a little bit more than that. But anyway, he was a Navy guy, and he was, his assignment was in this battleship to sit down in the belly of the ship. He was working in one of those rooms that are way down below and have no view of the outside. And the only thing in the room that really indicates the movement of the ship, because you don't have any external clues with your vision to see what the ship's doing, the only clue is that there's sort of a pendulum in the room that swings back and forth to show you sort of the movement of the ship. Because from your own position, relatively speaking, it looks like the room's standing still, but the pendulum's swinging. In truth, it's the room that's swinging as the ship moves in the waves, and that pendulum is hanging still. So anyway, he's down there, and they're in the middle of a big storm in the Pacific Ocean, and he's watching that pendulum swing back and forth in the middle of the room, and he knows that if it hits a certain point, that's all the ship can take. If it goes past this point in its arc, that means the ship is going to tip over and they're all going to sink. And he's watching this pendulum get closer and closer to that mark. And he prays. He prays and says, "Lord, if you save me, I'm going to devote the rest of my life to you." And wouldn't you know, they ride out the storm safely. The ship does not tip over. He likes to tell that the next morning he went up for breakfast in the commissary, and he was the only one on the ship that wasn't seasick because of all the violent swaying the ship had done. But he, like many, many faithful men and women who served in and around that war, Christian men and women, they encountered the grace of the Lord in some pretty powerful ways, even in the midst of warfare and devastation. That was a bit of a tangent. I didn't mean to tell you my grandpa's testimony, but there you go. All right, so let me see. Oh, yeah. Declines in church attendance in Europe and North America. This is sort of verifiably true just based on the statistical and the demographic data that we have. But it's not quite as alarming as some polls make it look. For instance, most of that decline is happening in certain areas of the church and not in others. For instance, you know, we talked a little bit about liberal theology, denominations that really have moved away from an insistence on the historic truth of Christianity. It tends to be those denominations that are really losing the most people and losing them the fastest. So much of the decline is actually being seen within liberal theological circles, not so much amongst Orthodox or Evangelicals or Pentecostals, folks that will tend to hold a harder line regarding the trustworthiness of Scripture and the reliability of traditional Christian doctrine. But you did have, starting in Europe, because that's sort of where the trend began, you did have a series of these other apologists, defenders of the faith, who arose. One of them was G.K. Chesterton, and I accidentally moved his picture to a different window when I was poking around there a minute ago, so let me find where good old Gilbert Keith has gone to. Here he is. Look at that picture. This guy's a great guy. This is one of my favorite writers in the history of Christianity. You know that old question, you know, if you were lost on a deserted island and you could only have a couple books with you, you know, maybe the Bible and something else, what would you have with you? I might take one of Chesterton's books, Orthodoxy. It's an apologetics book that he wrote. It's just, he's so smart and he's so funny and very inspirational as well. Just a marvelous man of God in many ways, and one of the greatest writers Christianity has ever produced. Speaking of which, Chesterton himself was asked that question once in an interview. He is a literary figure, and so he was on some kind of panel. And the journalist asked him, "Mr. Chesterton, if you were stranded on a deserted island and you could only have one book with you, what would it be?" And, you know, so all the other panelists are naming off their favorite books, you know, the works of Shakespeare or whatever it might be. And it comes to Chesterton and he says, I think the book I should like to have is Johnson's Practical Guide to Boat Building. You know what? That's actually a pretty good answer. If you were on a deserted island, that's the book you should want. Anyway, he actually went through a period. So he's fairly early on in the 20th century. His most prolific period of writing was from about 1900 to 1930. And he really attained fame in that first decade of the 20th century. So he's a British guy. He was a journalist. And at first, he was actually not a Christian at all. He kind of fell away from the faith. He, influenced by German philosophers like Friedrich Nietzsche, he kind of gave up on any sense of truth, became a nihilist, fell into a deep depression, but then slowly came back to the faith. And he describes his conversion in that book, Orthodoxy, of sort of this picture of rediscovering a wonderful land that was always there in front of him. And he finally was able to find it. He actually had kind of a really interesting spiritual story. Came back to the Christian faith, was Anglican, as most Christians in England were at the time, then drifted towards what we would call High Church Anglicanism. Very liturgical, very sacramental, and eventually went all the way to Roman Catholicism, based on some personal experiences of his own life, and he's written some books about that as well. You wouldn't really get much of, from most of his books, Orthodoxy, I think, was written while he was an Anglican. Most of his books, you know, you won't get a lot of really strenuous Catholic content. There is some of it there in his later works, but he does a good job of explaining kind of what led him on that path. There's a really flattering caricature someone drew of him. He was a big guy, rotund guy. This particular sheet that I handed, that's one of these handouts that I designed, I would encourage you, I'm not going to do it now, but when you get a chance, read through these quotes that I picked out from him. I had to put an extra page on because there's so many great quotes from him. But just winsome, smart, funny. And a lot of what he says is just right on the money and still on the money today. Like this one. Here's a good political statement for our age. And he wrote this 100 years ago. The whole modern world has divided itself into conservatives and progressives. The business of progressives is to go on making mistakes. The business of conservatives is to prevent the mistakes from being corrected. Well, there you go. He was one who liked to kind of poke fun at both ways, but he was always firmly standing up for the truth of Christianity. And so there really are some marvelous insights that he has. Here, the one more quote here. This is part of his description of why he came back to the faith. The more I considered Christianity, the more I found that while it had established a rule and order, the chief aim of that order was to give room for good things to run wild. I just love the way he puts things. Anyway, he was one of this new wave of apologists, of people who were defending the Christian faith in what was becoming more and more a hostile culture. And he wasn't the only one. Another quite famous one that, again, many of you are probably familiar with was this guy right here, C.S. Lewis. Clive Staples Lewis, Mere Christianity is his most prominent work of apologetics. Definitely worth reading, but all of his books are worth reading. These first three that I've listed here, Mere Christianity, Screwtape Letters, Great Divorce, those are all really powerfully done. I don't necessarily agree with everything Lewis says, but he's just so good in so many ways about expressing the Christian faith in a way that makes sense to the modern world. You had him, you had guys like Francis Schaeffer as well, another great apologetics figure from the mid-20th century. And people at this time were really striving, trying to figure out, how do you do evangelism? How do you reach non-Christians with the gospel during this kind of time? One major person who did that, of course, was Billy Graham. And he followed the model that had been laid out by guys like Charles Finney, D.L. Moody, who we touched on last time, leading over into ministries like Billy Sunday in the early 20th century. And then Billy Graham was probably the most prolific of all. Just the number of people that he was able to speak to regarding the gospel, not only here in the U.S., but all around the world. It was just pretty phenomenal. And so he used that kind of crusade format of going from city to city, organizing massive events and speaking to large audiences. At the same time, you had a growing attention to what's called friendship evangelism, because both Billy Graham and the proponents of friendship evangelism were dealing with one of these realities, which is people aren't coming into church as much anymore. Like, people off the street, people who are non-Christians or nominal Christians. There was a period in American history where they would just go to church because that's what you did on Sunday. They're not doing that anymore. So how do we reach them? Graham's model was you go and throw these massive crusades that people can invite their friends to, and you preach to huge audiences. Friendship evangelism was a different model, where you essentially said, okay, non-Christians aren't coming into church anymore, so we got to go to them. That means you equip the lay people in your congregation to be evangelists, to make friends out there in the town, to show the gospel by the words they speak and the way they live their lives. And so you kind of proceed one by one, face to face, just sharing the gospel from one person to the other in ordinary everyday living. Other big movements in American Christianity of the time were the Civil Rights Movement. Martin Luther King Jr., of course, is the standout representative in our country of that process. He was a Baptist pastor, actually American Baptist pastor. And you know what? I thought I had a note sheet for him, and I must not have sent that one out. My apologies for that. I'm sure I have one somewhere. My church actually has, here's just another little tie-in from Maine. My church has a connection to Martin Luther King Jr. He never came to our church, but one of our pastors back in the 1930s here in Calais went on to become the seminary professor who was really the main theological mentor for Martin Luther King Jr. His name is George W. Davis. So George W. Davis was a pastor here at Second Baptist of Calais, then went on and became a mentor figure to Martin Luther King Jr. Later on in his ministry. Kind of a neat little follow-up to that. So the Civil Rights Movement really was driven by Christian ideals. Many of these African-American churches, but a lot of white Christians and churches as well, coming in alongside them, recognizing, you know, what Scripture proclaims about the equality inherent in being a child of God. As Paul says, right, there's neither Greek nor Jew nor slave nor free when it comes to the cross of Christ. The Civil Rights Movement really follows on a long tradition of American Christians working to fix social problems. Just like we were talking about earlier with the temperance movement, you know, it had been kind of a prominent fixture of American Christian life that we should be active in working in our society. and still true today, right? Christians on both sides of the spectrum get a lot of flack for, you know, being as involved in politics as we might tend to be, but it comes from a pretty honest and sincere place, not just from our theological convictions, but also from the tradition of the way American Christianity has developed. That we are a people who want to be active in the world and believe that that God can use these means to do real good in the world. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that because most of the civil rights issues are really within the lived experience of all of us who are sitting here. And so I'm sure many of you know a good deal more about aspects of that than I do. I also have a few other things I want to get to here, so I'm going to press on. One thing I want to mention, you know, when we think about post-Christian societies, someone might have said the same about Russia and Eastern Europe back in the 20th century, right? Because they were under these communist regimes, which were avowedly atheist, persecuted the church. And you had several generations of Eastern Europeans and Russians who grew up essentially with no religious grounding at all. If they had anything, it was very secretively done and only in the context of one's own home. And even there, people were worried that there might be informants or someone listening, or that the public school is training your kids to report on you. Religion really effectively died out under communist oppression. Not entirely, of course, but they did a pretty good job of stamping it down. Here's what I want to point out, though, is that you might look at that and say, okay, I mean, if we're talking about post-Christian societies, that sounds like a post-Christian society. They have been Christian, very, very prominently Catholic, Eastern Orthodox, some Reformed churches in Eastern Europe and Russia. And all of a sudden in the 20th century, it's gone or brutally repressed down to a very, very minority level. What's happened just in the past 30 years since the Berlin Wall fell, since the USSR crumbled? You have seen a massive resurgence of traditional Christianity all across those countries. Soviet atheism failed in pretty dramatic fashion. If you go back to almost any Eastern European country now, with a couple of exceptions, there are a couple that are still very secular. The Czech Republic, for instance. Hungary is still fairly secular, although that's changing. But in most of those countries, you go back to them, and you'll find that the vast majority of the population will call themselves Christians. And they've generally gone back to those traditional forms of Christianity that were ancestral in those regions, primarily Eastern Orthodoxy. But a lot of people really hold it very passionately. There's been this amazing resurgence of Christianity in Eastern Europe after being pushed down to almost nothing. So that's really an important movement in church history of our day. So when we assess our own present moment through a historical lens, I think we've got a, you know, there's sometimes a tendency to rush to judgment, to say, oh, everything's just kind of sliding downhill, everything's, you know, people are losing faith, maybe this is the end times, and who knows, maybe it is. But I think history would tell us that we ought not to jump to that conclusion right away. We ought not to jump to the conclusion that this is just a downward slope all the way out from here. Because the cycle that we see throughout church history is that when you have these kinds of movements of loss of faith, you usually see an upswing on the other side. You usually see some kind of great move of God that brings people back to faith. And so that's my hope for our own generation and for those coming up behind us. I think what we see today, we do see a lot of people renouncing any religious affiliation, including Christian affiliations. But you also see still a really tremendous spiritual openness amongst many young people. They may not call themselves Christians necessarily, but most of them are not calling themselves, you know, devoted atheists either. Many are really in a place of seeking deeper truth, and I think that provides the church with an opening to say that our little part of history here doesn't have to be post-Christian. It could, in fact, be pre-Christian, if you want to put it that way. And there may yet be more of the story yet to come. So if we look at our own moment today, I called this historical turning points in the present moment. This is completely speculative on my part, right? Because history is the study of the past. Right now, what I'm going to try to tell you is, here are some things that I think are happening right now that will prove to be historically significant when we look back on them later on. Whether they pan out that way, I'm not here to say one way or the other, but I do think there are some pretty incredible things that are happening right now that will be of historical significance. The first one, major translations and major milestones in Bible translation and unreached people groups. So through 2,000 years of church history, we have never successfully had a place where we have a representation of the gospel accessible to every single people group on earth, every single ethnic, linguistic people group. It's never happened. We've never been at that point. Within our generation, possibly within a decade or a decade and a half, we will be there. For the first time in the history of Christianity, we will be at a place where every single ethnic and linguistic people group has at least some access to the gospel of Jesus Christ. That has never happened before, and we are right on the threshold of it right now. So that is an incredible milestone in the history of the church. If we can get to that place, I mean, that's a fulfillment of the vision of Revelation, right? That he looks out and he sees people from every tribe and language and people and nation around the throne of God. We've never been at a place before in the history of the church where that's been a possibility, but it is now. Mission agencies that focus on unreached people groups have plans in place, strategies in place within the next decade or so to have a living witness and hopefully at least one established church in each one of these ethnic and linguistic people groups around the world. Same with Bible translations. We're at the place where we're probably within 10 or 20 years of having at least some portion of Scripture available in every viable language in the world. Never happened before in history, but we're this close to it. I think that's really exciting. I also say here the flourishing of kingdom movements around the world. One of the major movements of God that if you pay attention to mission circles, you'll hear them talking about is this one. They've started tracking what they call mission movements. Sometimes they're called disciple-making movements or DMMs. And what they do is they track sort of what we might call revivals, but really they're sort of new developments of churches and places that haven't had them. And if a new church planting movement goes in, plants a church, is able to make disciples, plant another church, do it again and again, if that can happen for four generations of church plants, which sometimes happens within a single year, that's what they count as a disciple-making movement or a kingdom movement. And right now, there are more than 1,000. I think there's close to 2,000 of these kingdom movements that they've identified happening around the world, many of them in pretty hard-to-reach places like Iran, certain hostile areas of India, where indigenous believers are going in, planting churches that are seeing rapid, rapid growth. So that's something to keep your eye on as we think about the global expansion of Christianity, that there are some fairly exciting things happening in the world today. And it ties into the next point, the growth of Christianity in Muslim-majority areas. Obviously, Christianity is still very much a minority in most of those places, North Africa, the Middle East, and so on. However, we are seeing more and more Muslims come to faith in Jesus now than ever before in history. In fact, we've seen more of them come to faith in Jesus just since the turn of the century than in all of the previous centuries combined. What we're seeing happening in places like this is pretty frequent stories of Muslims coming forward with reports of encountering Jesus in dreams and being told to seek out missionaries. It's anecdotal evidence. So with anecdotal evidence, you always have that question of how reliable are these reports. But we're seeing them so frequently and so much across the board of different missionary agencies that it does seem like there's a really impressive movement underway. For instance, the fastest growing, the place where Christianity is growing the fastest at the moment, and this has been the case for the past couple of years as well, is Iran. That's the fastest growing Christian movement in the world, is in the Islamic Republic of Iran. On the flip side of that, though, is that you also have massive persecution, right? As Christianity gains a larger profile in areas that have been hostile to it, it also attracts a great deal more persecution. When we think about persecution often with the early church under the Roman Empire, but we right now are living in the age of the greatest persecution of Christians of all of church history. And I'm not, you know, sometimes people talk about persecution of Christians here in America as, you know, being face down with hostility for our positions. That is a form of persecution if you want to put it that way, but that's not really what I'm talking about. I'm talking about believers who are really risking their lives every day simply for the sake of being a Christian. That happens much more often now and in the 20th century than ever before in church history. There were more martyrs in the 20th century than in all the previous 19 centuries combined. So we are living both in the age of the greatest growth of the Christian church the world has ever seen and the severest persecution of the Christian church that the world has ever seen. We don't always see that from where we sit because the story here in America has been a little bit different, but it's something we ought to be aware of when we think about global Christianity. The last two big ones I put down here are Christianity in China, Christianity in America. I've already shared with you a little bit some of my hopes for Christianity in America. I'm not a prophet. I don't know if we are called to be workers in the next great revival or if we will continue to see a diminishment of the gospel's influence in our lifetime. It could be either of those things. But as Oswald Chambers used to say, we are not called to success, we're called to faithfulness. So whether the Lord brings success in terms of revival, full churches, you know, he will do what he will do. We are called to be faithful. And I pray and hope for a great move of God in our midst. But mostly our call is simply to follow faithfully where he leads. Christianity in China, that's one I'm keeping my eye on. That Christianity has exploded in China under the communist regime. A persecuted church, but a vibrant church. In fact, there are more Christians in communist China than there are Christians in the United States right now. But within just a decade or two, there will be likely more Christians in China than there are people in the United States. So we talked about Africa really becoming one of the powerhouses of Christianity in this century. It is entirely possible that China will be that too. I don't know exactly what that will look like simply because of the active persecution of their government, but they are a church to keep in your prayers. So that's my wild speculations on the moment of church history in which we find ourselves. But I wanted to leave you with that, because the study of church history, right, it's not just the study of the past. It's the application of seeing those patterns of the way God has worked and looking for his work in our own time. It might look different than it's looked in the past, but it might also look a lot like some of the things he's done before in great awakenings or revivals or persecutions. So I really think the study of church history informs so much of the way we carry out our ministry and the perspective that we pass on to our people. Well, that's all, folks. Like usual, I've prattled on all the way through all of my allotted time. But I thank you so much for walking this journey with me.